Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents City of Inmates, Conquest, Rebellion, and the Rise of Human Caging in Los Angeles, 1771 to 1965, by Kelly Lytle Hernandez. Narrated by Lisa Renee Pitts. Publisher's note. The print and e-book versions of this book include visual content such as maps, tables, and illustrations. Introduction. Conquest and incarceration. Mass incarceration is mass elimination. That is the punchline of this book. I had trouble arriving at such an unsettling idea. But the collection of 2 centuries of evidence documenting the long rise of incarceration in Los Angeles left me no other interpretation. Incarceration operates as a means of purging, removing, caging, containing, erasing, disappearing, and eliminating targeted populations from land, life, and society in the United States. Why Los Angeles? Los Angeles is a hub of incarceration, imprisoning more people than any other city in the United States, which incarcerates more people than any other nation on earth. Each night, nearly 17,000 men, women, and youth are locked somewhere in Los Angeles County's $1 billion system of jails, detention centers, and one penal farm. There are also 88 other municipal jails, more than 20 juvenile detention halls and camps, and 2 federal facilities sited within the county. And just over the mountains lining the northeastern edge of Los Angeles County, GEO Group, a private prison company, operates a large immigrant detention center that contracts with the federal government to hold the spillover of deportees from the city. Therefore, in both size and scope, the project of human caging in Los Angeles is massive. Some say no city in the world incarcerates more people than Los Angeles. If so, Los Angeles, the city of angels, is in fact the city of inmates, the carceral capital of the world. By explaining when, why, and how Los Angeles became the city of inmates, this book digs up the roots of the nation's carceral core. It is a story that has never been told before. When I first began to research the rise of incarceration in Los Angeles, I quickly learned that L.A.'s penal habits took root much earlier than what scholars generally define as the age of mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is a relatively recent development, with sparks and triggers particular to the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Federal, state, and local authorities steadily expanded the nation's imprisoning capacity to crush the political insurgencies of the 1960s, as well as warehouse, discipline, and contain the massive land and labor dislocations wrought by globalization during the 1970s. Then, in the early 1980s, the national rate of incarceration skyrocketed when President Ronald Reagan declared the war on drugs, triggering millions of arrests on both drug and violence charges. Police forces across the country also adopted the broken windows theory of policing, arresting millions upon millions on public order charges. By the end of the decade, the rate of incarceration in the United States topped historically uncharted levels. Never before had the United States caged such a large, or dark, percentage of its human population. Blacks and Native peoples, after all, share the highest rates of incarceration in the United States. They also share the highest rates of killings by police officers. And Latinos, namely Mexicans and Central Americans, fill the nation's immigrant detention centers, which began to expand during the 1990s as new investments in U.S. immigration control and border enforcement funded millions of deportations. By 2010, the United States operated the largest immigrant detention system on Earth. And in recent years, U.S. attorneys have aggressively prosecuted non-citizens for unlawful entry, sending thousands upon thousands of immigrants to federal prison every year. With Mexicans and Central Americans comprising nearly 97% of all deportees and 92% of all immigrants imprisoned for unlawful re-entry, U.S. immigration control is the most highly racialized police and penal system in the United States today. But incarceration, and the patterns it harbors, boomed in Los Angeles far earlier than any of this. In fact, Los Angeles had become the carceral capital of the United States as early as the 1950s. Earlier still, the rate of incarceration during the 1930s in Los Angeles was no different than it is today. By 1910, Los Angeles already operated one of the largest jail systems in the country. And as far back as the 1850s, the small town's county jail was incessantly overcrowded. In other words, something with a very deep reach stirred the penal brew in Los Angeles. I did not know what it was, and the extent historiography of incarceration in the United States, which largely focuses on the particularities of race and labor in the U.S. South and the urban North, did not and could not answer all the questions I had about how a town in the U.S. West grew into the nation's, if not the world's, leading site of human caging. Race and labor were certainly key, but what about other central themes in the history of the U.S. West? What about indigeneity? What about immigration? What about borders and borderlands? Full of these questions and many more, I headed to the archives to figure out the L.A. story. I quickly discovered that an archival void blankets much of the history of imprisonment in Los Angeles. Sometime after Edward Escobar conducted research for his influential study, Race, Police, and the Making of a Political Identity, Mexican Americans and the Los Angeles Police Department, 1900 to 1945. The Los Angeles Police Department, LAPD, as well as the LA City Archives, destroyed all but four boxes of the LAPD's historical records. Similarly, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, LASD, either does not have or will not share its records. The California Public Records Act exempts the state's police forces from archiving most of the records they create. Therefore, the core institutional records related to the history of filling and managing the jails of Los Angeles are unavailable for public inquiry. But I was confident that the rise of incarceration in Los Angeles could not be so easily erased. Incarceration is a social institution. As the sociologist David Garland explains, the politics and processes of criminalization, arrest, detention, and punishment are fiercely entangled within diverse currents of political and cultural life. The idea of putting people in cages and the practices used to hold them there stretch beyond steel bars and stone walls. Therefore, I knew that the evidence of LA's carceral past had to be deposited far and wide. To find it, I would just have to look further, search wider, and dig deeper. So that is what I did. For 7 years, I pored over the city's newspapers, noting any mention of jails. I scoured the personal papers of local elites, authorities, and activists, copying down any reference to incarceration. Similarly, I combed the records of local institutions and organizations, such as public health agencies, labor unions, the city council, unemployment bureaus, and political groups. I hung out in the basement of the Los Angeles County Courthouse, calling up cases from the past. The clerks would only give me 3 files at a time. It took a while. When several of my archival finds pointed beyond the city, I followed them too, reviewing a map once hidden in a Spanish colonial vault, scanning slave censuses written on South Carolina plantations, and even decrypting coded letters mailed to Mexico City. It was a grueling archival slog, but the chase was rewarding. Despite the destruction of public records, the making of the largest jail system in the United States left 200 years of evidence scattered across the city, the nation, and the world. Those who hoped to leverage human caging in Los Angeles to resolve social tensions and reach political objectives, both deep within and far beyond the city, wrote decrees, passed laws, published articles, and signed contracts, leaving behind reams of archived records. In general, they tended to be people with enough substantive political and cultural power to orchestrate who gets criminalized and incarcerated and who does not. Among them were colonists, citizens, landowners, and even foreign presidents. But many people fought the rise of incarceration in Los Angeles. They were an eclectic bunch, including the incarcerated as well as journalists, musicians, migrants, mothers, and many others. They, too, left records. In fact, rebels and their many struggles with incarceration clog the historical record. The words and deeds of dissidents constitute what I call a rebel archive that evaded LAPD and LASD destruction. Comprised mostly of broken locks, secret codes, handbills, scribbled manifestos, and songs, the Rebel Archive found refuge in far-flung boxes and obscure remnants. But it also thrives in plain sight. The rebels' words thundered in the halls of the U.S. Congress. Their resistance forced the U.S. Supreme Court to issue emergency rulings, and their rebellions broke across bars and borders, changing the world in which we live. And in the summer of 1965, an uprising against the violence of human caging in the city exploded, burning the carceral core of Los Angeles to the ground, but leaving an archive of ashes and embers behind. I collected every scribble, song, and ember I could find. In the end, the Rebel Archive held more than enough evidence for me to write 6 stories spanning 2 centuries. The first story begins many millennia ago, when the region, now called the Los Angeles Basin, was solely occupied by the indigenous communities today collectively known as the Tongva Gabrielino Tribe. This story is vital because there is no evidence that Tongva Gabrielino communities ever tried or experienced human caging until the Spanish Crown dispatched a small group of colonists to establish El Pueblo de Nuestra, Señora la Reina de Los Ángeles del Río Porciúncula, the City of Angels, in 1781. One of the first structures these colonists built was a jail. In time, the colonists and their descendants filled the jail with indios. Throughout the next century of colonial occupation in the Tongva Basin, spanning the Spanish colonial period, 1781 to 1821, the Mexican era, 1821 to 48, and the early years of U.S. rule, 1848 to 70s, indigenous peoples consistently comprised a substantive, if not majority, portion of the incarcerated population in Los Angeles. Chapter 1, therefore, firmly grounds the origins of incarceration in Los Angeles with the dynamics of conquest and colonialism in the Tongva Basin. Chapter 2 moves deeper into the U.S. era, chronicling how, between the 1880s and 1910s, authorities in Los Angeles redirected and expanded the city's carceral capacity. They did so while targeting a particular population, poor white men, namely those popularly disparaged as tramps and hobos, for migrating constantly, working little, and living and loving beyond the bounds of the nuclear family ideal. By 1910, when white men comprised nearly 100% of the local jail population, Los Angeles operated one of the largest jail systems in the country. And as the city rapidly grew during these years, Los Angeles authorities operated a large convict labor program. In turn, white men sentenced to the chain gang cut roads, beautified parks, built schools, and so on. Chapter 2 details the rise of white male incarceration at the turn of the 20th century and unveils the little-known history of how incarcerated white men built the infrastructure of the growing city. From Sunset Boulevard to the paths winding around Dodger Stadium, city residents still walk, ride, and run on the imprint of their labors. The third chapter is a Western tale of national and global import. That tale, which sutures the split between the history of incarceration within the United States and the history of deportation from the United States, swirls around the passage of the 1892 Geary Act, a federal law that required all Chinese laborers in the United States to prove their legal residence and register with the federal government or be subject to up to 1 year of imprisonment at hard labor and then deportation. Chinese immigrants rebelled against the new law, refusing to be locked out, kicked out, or singled out for imprisonment. Launching the first mass civil disobedience campaign for immigrant rights in the history of the United States, Chinese immigrants forced the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a set of sweeping and enduring decisions regarding the future of U.S. immigration control. Buried in those decisions, which cut through Los Angeles during the summer of 1893, lay the invention of immigrant detention as a non-punitive form of caging non-citizens within the United States. It was then an obscure and contested practice of indisputably racist origins. It is now one of the most dynamic sectors of the U.S. carceral landscape. The fourth chapter sheds new historical insight on a key but little-studied demographic of incarceration in the United States, Mexicanos, including immigrants from Mexico and U.S.-born persons of Mexican descent. It is a story that unfolded across the U.S.-Mexico borderlands but peaked in Los Angeles when, in the summer of 1907, two LAPD officers kicked in the door of a shanty on the outskirts of town and arrested three leaders of a rebel movement to oust Mexico's president, Porfirio Diaz. These men, Ricardo Flores Magón, Librado Rivera, and Antonio Villarreal, were political exiles living in hiding in the United States. Their arrests, as with the arrests of thousands of their supporters across the borderlands, were part of President Diaz's counterinsurgency campaign to cage, if not kill, Magón and crush his rebel movement, which demanded massive political reform and land redistribution in Mexico. Yet, while incarcerated in Los Angeles, Magón, Villarreal, and Rivera cultivated new ways to stoke rebellion in Mexico. Their ongoing assault on the Diaz regime pushed Mexico toward the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 17. Therefore, Chapter 4 unearths how the incarceration of Mexicanos in the United States surged during the Age of Revolution in Mexico. It is an epic tale. The fifth chapter continues to chart the rise of Mexican and Mexican-American incarceration in the United States. Like Magón's Rebellion, it is a tale that unfolded in Los Angeles and across the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Like the history of immigrant detention, it is a story about the collision of deportation and incarceration. But in particular, Chapter 5 examines how, during the 1920s and 1930s, the politics of controlling Mexican immigration to the United States directly prompted the criminalization of unauthorized border crossings and, in turn, triggered a steady rise in the number of Mexicans imprisoned within the United States. Home to the largest Mexican community within the United States, Los Angeles was ground zero for the politics and practices of Mexican incarceration in these years. The sixth and final story spans the decades between the 1920s and the 1960s. In these years, as Los Angeles took center stage in the nation's landscape of jails and prisons, the population of African Americans incarcerated in Los Angeles shot from politically irrelevant and slightly disproportionate to politically dominant and stunningly disproportionate. It has remained so ever since. Chapter 6 tracks the origins of the incarceration of blacks in Los Angeles. In particular, it details why and how black incarceration so disproportionately followed the expansion of LA's African-American community. Moreover, by exhuming the first recorded killing of a young black male by the LAPD, which occurred in South Central Los Angeles on the evening of April 24, 1927, this chapter details why and how police brutality so closely accompanied black incarceration in the city. It is a brutal history attended by persistent and, in time, explosive black protest, tracking how community members fought police brutality between 1927 and the outbreak of the Watts Rebellion in 1965. Indeed, race, policing and protest became inextricable as Los Angeles advanced toward becoming the carceral capital of the United States. Once pricked, each of these stories tumbled out of the rebel archive, and each revealed a key chapter from LA's carceral past with echoes in the nation's carceral present. Today, Indigenous peoples are one of the most disproportionately imprisoned populations in the United States. Houseless and racialized queer communities also experience high levels of policing. Immigration control remains a racialized enterprise, caging and removing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Mexicans, from the United States every year. And a stunning lethality remains bound to the caging of Black America. But all is not dire. Much like the Magonistas, incarcerated men, women, and youth and their allies continue to stoke transformative social movements. Therefore, each of the stories stands on its own as a distinct and urgent history of the present, and each story could be expanded into a book of its own. Together, the stories reveal something more. A hearty cord connects the chapters in this book. I did not see it at first, but after I pulled one story and then another from the Rebel Archive, I wrestled with how such diverse stories might fit together. The stories range from the Spanish colonial era to the outbreak of the 1965 Watts Rebellion, address issues from vagrancy laws to immigration control to police brutality, and twist and turn through a variety of communities at particular moments in time. Frankly, I was stunned by all that the Rebel Archive forced me to consider, and there was only one thing I knew for sure. These six stories were forcing me to think more historically, critically, and expansively than I ever imagined I would about the making and meaning of incarceration in Los Angeles. But in time, I began to see how each story aligned on the arc of conquest and, more specifically, settler colonialism in the city. The United States is a settler society. As such, its cultures and institutions are rooted in a particular form of conquest and colonization called settler colonialism. Settler colonialism differs from other, more familiar systems of colonialism because it is not organized around resource extraction or labor exploitation. Resource extraction, such as mining, and labor exploitation, such as chattel slavery, can and certainly do occur in settler societies. But neither extraction nor exploitation is the principal objective of settler colonial projects. Rather, settler colonial projects seek land. On that land, colonists envision building a new, permanent, reproductive, and racially exclusive society. To be clear, settlers harbor no intentions of merging with, submitting to, or even permanently lording over the indigenous societies already established within the targeted land base. Nor do settlers plan to leave or to return home someday. Rather, settlers invade in order to stay and reproduce while working in order to remove, dominate, and ultimately replace the indigenous populations. In the words of historian Patrick Wolfe, settler societies are premised on the elimination of the native. In addition to native elimination, settler societies strive to block, erase, or remove racialized outsiders from their claimed territory. Even as many settler societies depend on racialized workforces, settler cultures, institutions, and politics simultaneously trend toward excluding racialized workers from full inclusion in the body politic, corralling their participation in community life, and largely shaped by rising and falling labor demands, deporting, hiding or criminalizing them, or otherwise revoking the right of racialized outsiders to be within the invaded territory. Settlers rarely agree on how to accomplish any of this. For example, some settlers import, recruit, or otherwise cultivate structurally marginalized and racialized workforces, such as enslaved Africans in southern cotton fields, contracted Chinese laborers on Western railroads, and unauthorized Mexican border crossers on Southwestern farms. Their objective is to fuel the expansion of settler-dominated industries with cheap, subjugated, and when possible, disposable labor. Settler factions seeking total racial purity within the settler-claimed territory fiercely contest their actions. So settlers furiously debate one another over how to best promote their interests and dominance over land and life in the invaded territory. And targeted communities always fight back, finding many ways to elude elimination and undermine disappearance. Therefore, what matters in the analysis of settler societies is not so much whether processes of native elimination and racial disappearance are consistent or ever achieved, but rather how settler fantasies perpetually trend settler societies toward these ends. As Lorenzo Veracini puts it, the settler colonial situation is generally understood as an inherently dynamic circumstance where both indigenous and exogenous others progressively disappear in a variety of ways. Throughout this book, I use a variety of terms to describe what Veracini calls projects of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?